Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 236. It's Monday, November 13th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get started with a seasonal story. This from Medical Express. Majority of workers at America's nursing homes unvaccinated against flu or COVID. Healthcare workers at America's nursing homes are woefully undervaccinated for both flu and COVID-19, threatening their own health and that of the frail elderly patients under their care, a new report finds. Looking at 2023 data collected at nearly 14,000 nursing homes nationwide, researchers found that fewer than one of every four, 23% of healthcare workers, had received up-to-date COVID vaccines, while less than half, 47%, had gotten the latest flu shot. The new report looked at data on staff vaccination rates at U.S. acute care hospitals and nursing homes, gathered from the CDC's National Healthcare Safety Network. Data was collected on over 2 million healthcare workers at nearly 14,000 nursing homes nationwide, as well as about 9 million staffers at over 4,000 hospitals across America. Healthcare workers at hospitals had better vaccination rates against the flu in 2023 compared to those working at nursing homes. 81% had gotten the latest shot. However, up-to-date COVID immunization was very low among hospital staff, with just 17% having gotten the latest vaccines. Nursing home staff vaccination rates were low and varied widely depending on where in the country the facility was located. For example, almost 41% of workers in nursing homes on the West Coast were up to date on their COVID shots, compared to less than 18% of those in the South. Similar disparities were seen when it came to vaccination against the flu. In certain southern states, such as Alabama, Florida, Kentucky, Louisiana, and Missouri, less than 10% of staff at acute care hospitals were up to date on their COVID shots in 2023, the report found. So, for whatever your thinking is about where we're at with various respiratory pandemics, you know, people are kind of over COVID, but the elderly, particularly those in nursing homes or those are sick and in hospitals, are definitely vulnerable. We can certainly do better. Okay, well, next up, let's do a couple stories on chemical toxicities. First up from The Guardian, U.S. faces almost daily hazardous chemical accidents. Hazardous chemical accidents are occurring almost daily on average in the United States, exposing people to dangerous toxins through fires, explosions, leaks, spills, and other releases, according to a new analysis by nonprofit researchers. The report, prepared by Coming Clean in conjunction with a network of environmental and economic justice organizations in the Coalition to Prevent Chemical Disasters, documents what is called an alarming frequency of accidents, coming a month before U.S. regulators are expected to release final rules aimed at preventing such incidents. The research is based on capturing incidents of chemical spills via monitoring news sources. Researchers say the figure should be regarded as conservative because not all of them are reported in the news media. The majority of the incidents tallied are connected to the fossil fuel industry, including the use, transport, production, and disposal of fossil fuels and fossil fuel products, according to the report, which is accompanied by a searchable database of chemical incidents. Chemical disasters are happening across the entire chemical supply chain, which depends on fossil fuels for feedstock, energy, and distribution, said Maya Nye, Federal Policy Director for Coming Clean. So not only is the production of these chemicals contributing to chemical disasters, they are contributing to climate change and endangering worker and community safety throughout their existence. We have accepted this as the norm of the chemical industry for too long, says Matthew Stanislaus, who served as assistant administrator of the EPA's Office of Land and Emergency Management during the Obama administration. It has become embedded in the business model of the chemical industry. Citing his time in government, Stanislaus says pressure from powerful industry groups made it challenging to implement effective regulation. The report comes as the EPA works to finalize proposed changes to the program regulations that apply to plants dealing with hazardous chemicals. A final version is expected to be published in December. The proposed changes include enhanced emergency preparedness, increased public access to information about hazardous chemical risks that communities face, and new accident prevention requirements. The final rules are expected to take into account risks of extreme weather events associated with climate change, such as flooding and hurricanes. A 2022 GAO report specifically warned that more than 3,200 hazardous chemical facilities regulated by EPA are located in areas that could face heightened risk due to climate change-related events. The EPA has not been consistently assessing how these facilities manage those risks, the GAO said. Advocates for public safety and worker protections have battled with industry groups over the rule changes, with many advocates fearing the new rules will not go far enough to be truly protective, while business groups worry, of course, that new requirements will be overly onerous and costly. Costly for them, that is. The rest of us would greatly benefit. Okay, next up from Grist, mercury is still an environmental threat, especially for indigenous peoples. The negotiations produced no particularly big wins. There is still no agreement on a common global method to measure and identify mercury-contaminated waste from industrial sources, like chemical manufacturers or oil and gas operators. Mercury can still be purchased online and traded internationally, and states could not agree on when to pull it from tooth fillings. But there were some successes. Nations have agreed to ban the use of mercury as a preservative in cosmetics by 2025, as well as to increase support for indigenous peoples in future negotiations. Mercury, the silvery, highly toxic heavy metal, still poses a serious environmental and health threat throughout the world. And last week, world leaders met in Geneva for 5 days of negotiations in a bid to control mercury pollution, trade, and use. Mercury is used in a range of products, including skin lightening cosmetics, batteries, fluorescent lighting, pesticides, and dental amalgams to fill cavities. It is also a byproduct of coal-fired power plants and waste incineration. A decade ago, the United Nations adopted the Minamata Convention on Mercury to eliminate the effects of the chemical on people and the environment, named after Minamata Bay in Japan, where mercury-tainted wastewater poisoned more than 2,000 people in the 1950s and 60s. The debilitating illness was dubbed Minamata disease, which includes symptoms such as hearing and speech impairment, loss of coordination, muscle weakness, and vision impairment. Exposure to mercury produces significant adverse neurological and health effects, especially in fetuses and infants. Human exposure to the chemical typically comes from eating contaminated fish where the chemical bioaccumulates, dental amalgams, and occupational exposure at jobs where mercury is present, like mines, waste facilities, and dentist office. The Golden Minamata Convention, which was adopted in 2013 and became legally binding in 2017, is to eventually eliminate the use of mercury. The convention has led to the phase-out of a wide range of products that contain the chemicals, like batteries, compact fluorescent lights, pesticides, thermometers, and other measurement devices, while industrial processes that relied heavily on mercury, like the production of chlorine, are now almost non-existent. Today, the world trade of mercury has dropped significantly. But there is still demand for the chemical. The biggest driver of the mercury market is by far artisanal and small-scale gold mining operations, where one of the fastest, most cost-effective ways to extract gold from ore is to mix it with mercury, separating gold powder and flecks from low-quality deposits. Artisanal and small-scale gold mining operations account for nearly 20% of the world's gold supply, which means the rise and fall of the mercury trade is driven by demand for gold. These operations are particularly prevalent in the Amazon, Indonesia, and Western Africa, and release 35% of all mercury pollution to the environment, creating newly toxic sites at rates that vastly outpace cleanup efforts and impacting both indigenous peoples as well as local communities. Representatives from Latin America, the Caribbean, Australia, and Canada noted that both indigenous peoples as well as local communities are particularly vulnerable to mercury exposure, and are among the first to face serious health and environmental impacts from mercury pollution, owing to their close relationships with the environment. Grassy Narrows First Nation in Ontario, Canada, for instance, has seen three generations of mercury exposure. In the 1960s and 70s, a paper mill dumped nearly 10 tons of mercury into the river the First Nation relies on for fish. A recent study linked high rates of attempted suicide among Indigenous youth to intergenerational mercury exposure. In California, historic mines left over from the gold rush in the mid-1800s posed public health, land management, and environmental challenges to tribal, state, and federal agencies. Where countries have banded together to tackle the issue of mercury, reaching international consensus is, unsurprisingly, difficult. No consensus could be made on the question of mercury waste thresholds, how much mercury can be in waste that countries export. The agreement made this last week is 15 milligrams per kilo, and while experts say the number is tolerable for the time being and could likely come down in the future, the greatest concern among advocates is around the adoption of an, quote, opt-out clause around waste. What that's done is open the floodgates for any country, if they don't want to use the 15 milligrams a kilo, to use any threshold they like, any measurement technique they like, any classification system they like, said Lee Bell, policy advisor for the International Pollutants Elimination Network. It's now effectively a free-for-all where any country can declare or not declare certain types of waste to be mercury waste. According to Bell, this has massive impacts on the movement of waste across international borders. Then there's the matter of dentistry. Mercury is still used in tooth fillings, and in the United States, some of the most common recipients of dental amalgams are low-income children of color, prisoners, members of the military, and Indian Health Service patients. While the science behind the safety of these fillings has been inconsistent, to date, nearly 40 countries have generally banned the use of dental amalgams or set hard dates of complete phase-outs, while another 40 countries have phased down the use of mercury fillings in children under 15 years old, as well as pregnant and breastfeeding women. Stopping the use of dental amalgams would also have impacts on the supply chain. While most countries, including the U.S., are working to phase down dental amalgam use, the COP5 did not produce hard dates for a complete phase-out. Although one positive outcome is that states must now develop plans on how they will phase down mercury fillings and report back to the convention. But more broadly, one reason many countries have failed to make progress on this concerns the possibility of litigation. It comes down to this issue of admitting that it was harmful all along, said Bell. There's a strong defense of the current position, so what you're seeing is more of an incremental position where they want to phase it down and slowly bring supplies down over time. In the long run, that means there's no firm date on when that might take place and won't be discussed until the next round of negotiations in 2 years. There was one bright spot this week, though. World leaders agreed to broaden the participation of indigenous peoples at future meetings, acknowledging that the impacts of mercury, particularly due to mining, have disproportionate impacts on indigenous peoples. It's a vague reference to the potential for a funding mechanism to get more indigenous peoples to future negotiations, but a significant one for future representatives. We're encouraged that there is increased support from states as well as recognition of our unique political status, said Rochelle Diver, UN Environmental Treaties Coordinator for the International Indian Treaty Council. Indigenous people are disproportionately impacted by legal and illegal gold mining, making future generations intensely vulnerable to mercury's toxic legacy. The next meeting will take place in 2025. Okay, next up from Civil Eats, the FDA is still not tracking how farms use antibiotics. Antibiotic resistance is a growing public health concern, and animal agriculture is a known factor. But experts say the agency is dragging its feet on collecting available data, such as the antibiotics added to feed. When bacteria develop resistance to frontline antibiotics, healthcare professionals lose their ability to treat deadly infections, leading to more than 35,000 deaths annually in the U.S. and more than 1.2 million deaths worldwide. For that reason, antibiotic resistance has been held up by the World Health Organization as one of the most pressing threats to global health. Researchers see the potential overuse of those antibiotics in agriculture as a key driver of antibiotic resistance, but they've often struggled to access basic information about how many animals are receiving the drugs, for what purpose, and for how long. Collecting that farm-level data is a critical missing piece in the Food and Drug Administration's 5-year plan, launched in 2019, to improve, quote, antimicrobial stewardship in animal agriculture, advocates say. Now the deadline is approaching, and while the agency has made other significant regulatory changes in years before and since, the FDA is not regularly tracking or reporting how antibiotics are used on farms, nor does it have a plan in place to do so in the short term. Instead, the agency funded a few small pilot projects that collected data in 2016 and 2017 and published one-time results in 2020. Then, in 2021, FDA commissioned an 18-month, quote, stakeholder engagement project run by a partner foundation to explore setting up a voluntary antibiotic use reporting system in collaboration with the animal agriculture industry. Neither effort has proven very effective. According to multiple experts, however, FDA does have access to some important data that could be a game changer if the agency chose to use it. That's because most antibiotics given to farm animals are mixed into their feed at feed mills, FDA-regulated facilities that are required to keep records on prescriptions and distribution, and although those records could begin to paint a picture of what antibiotic use on American farms looks like and help uncover ways to prevent overuse, FDA is simply not collecting them. This data is at the feed mill, said Laura Rogers, deputy director of the Antibiotic Resistance Action Center at George Washington University. If the agency really wanted this information, they could figure out how to get it. In an email, FDA spokesperson Veronica Fofoli emphasized that the agency is committed to antimicrobial stewardship in veterinary settings and pointed out other steps it has taken on the issue. For instance, since 2017, the agency has made at least three changes experts consider consequential. It outlawed the use of antibiotics solely to promote faster animal growth, although many of the same drugs now used for disease prevention also boost growth. Gradually made veterinary prescriptions a requirement for all antibiotics, also used antibiotics that are also used in human medicine, and set new limits on how long drugs should be administered. But efforts to gather basic data on how farms actually used antibiotics day by day, which Fofoli agreed is important to help us understand what drives antimicrobial resistance in animal agriculture, has lagged. Every year, animal drug manufacturers are required to report sales data to the FDA, and the FDA releases those numbers broken down by which animal species the drugs are sold for. After a large dip in 2016, when the FDA banned antibiotics used solely for growth promotion, sales in the pork and beef industries have gradually ticked back up. Chicken is the exception, as large swaths of the industry have eliminated medically important antibiotics entirely from their production based on consumer demand. The CDC has already been pushing on this point for the last several years, and they've beefed up their efforts to track antibiotic use in hospitals and in clinics, figure out how much overuse is happening, and then take steps to address it. But CDC only has authority over human medicine, while FDA handles drugs given to animals. That's what's missing on the animal side. Problems with a voluntary collection system. But the FDA believes it has a better plan: partner with animal agriculture companies to get farmers to voluntarily provide data on how they're using antibiotics. To that end, the agency commissioned the Reagan-Udall Foundation for the FDA, an independent nonprofit created by Congress, to advise the agency and gather feedback from the many individuals and groups engaged in the issue to explore how that could happen. Starting in January 2022, the Reagan-Udall Foundation began the first fact-finding phase of the project. Public health representatives were among the 30 stakeholder groups included in that process. But when the foundation released a report summing up the first phase, the advocates said they did not see any of the significant concerns they voiced reflected in the text. Producers using antibiotics responsibly might be more likely to submit voluntary data, while those overusing might be motivated to opt out. For example, in 2022, the Maryland Department of Agriculture sent notices to over 1,000 veterinarians asking them to submit information on antibiotics they prescribed that year. A total of 7 submitted data. 7 out of 1,000. So, voluntary regulations have a very limited use in many cases. Of course, that's what industry often pushes, saying, oh, you know, if we just get educated and work as a stakeholder, things will change. Doesn't work that way very often. When the public health is at stake, there needs to be regulations, and those regulations need to be enforced. And to be enforced, you need to know what's going on. Okay, well, that story fits as one small piece in a much larger story about the world's broken food system. This from Wired. The world's broken food system costs $12.7 trillion a year. That's with a T. $12.7 trillion a year. The United Nations has published a major new tally of the impact of the world's food system has on our health and the planet. According to a report from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the FAO, the total hidden cost of the world's food system adds up to $12.7 trillion, roughly 10% of the global GDP. The report analyzed the cost to health, society, and the environment embedded in the current food system. The biggest impact in monetary terms is on health. Globally, 73% of all the hidden costs accounted for by the FAO were associated with diets that led to obesity or non-communicable diseases like diabetes and heart disease. The next biggest impact in monetary terms was the environment, accounting for more than 20% of quantified hidden costs. The hidden costs of food systems change dramatically from country to country. In low-income countries, almost half of the hidden costs relate to poverty and may be partly caused by farmers not being able to grow enough food or not being paid a fair price for their products. In these countries, the hidden cost of food amounts to an average of 27% of GDP, compared with just 8% in high-income countries. The FAO's figures use 2020 purchasing power parity dollars, a way of comparing living standards across countries with very different incomes and prices. People's diets are one place where most high-income countries are failing drastically. In these countries, the FAO found that over 80% of the hidden costs of food are related to unhealthy diets. Some outliers might offer a hint for how to improve things. Japan has a smaller share of hidden food costs relative to GDP than countries like the US or Canada. Part of that might be because Japanese people tend to eat more fish and because their food is expensive, leading them towards healthier diets overall. They start from a culture that is more focused on good foods. In the West, governments could think about ways to get people who eat meat every day to reduce their intake by one or two meals a week. Ultimately, bringing down these hidden costs will require a combination of government action, individual actions, and more responsible behavior from the food industry. The FAO is already working on next year's report, which will present a series of case studies to help countries implement true cost accounting and begin to grapple with what the food system is actually costing them. So this, of course, is a huge dynamic in trying to implement good public health practices and policies, is that from a capitalistic business point of view, many businesses can externalize their costs. You can sell cheap, ultra-processed food, make a lot of money, and not have to pay the costs of the health damage that that does to a population. Somebody else, some other section of the economy, ends up paying for that.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
And on that same front, this from the Washington Post, nutrition guidelines may soon warn against ultra-processed foods. The guidelines could change the way Americans view nutrition by focusing on how their food is made and what happens to it before they bring it home. For decades, the federal government's dietary guidelines have urged people to eat plenty of foods rich in vitamins, minerals, fiber, and protein, while warning us to steer clear of foods high in sodium, sugar, and saturated fat. But now, the scientific experts who shape the way we eat might start warning consumers against eating too many ultra-processed foods. For the first time, the Guidelines Committee is examining the science on obesity and ultra-processed foods, industrially manufactured foods that have unusual combinations of flavors, additives, and ingredients, many of which are not found in nature. These include things like chicken nuggets, sweetened breakfast cereals, boxed macaroni and cheese, frozen dinners, potato chips, and fast food. The committee's conclusions could lead to a seminal change in how Americans view nutrition, forcing them to think beyond the basic nutrients in a food and instead consider how their food is made and what happens to it before it reaches their table. A big change to the country's diet. In recent years, dozens of studies have found that people who consume a lot of ultra-processed foods have higher rates of weight gain, obesity, cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and other chronic diseases. Nutrition experts say that highlighting ultra-processed foods in the upcoming guidelines could have a significant effect on the country's diet and national food programs. The dietary guidelines help determine which foods can be served to the approximately 30 million American children who participated in the National School Lunch Program, for instance. The guidelines influence the food industry, food assistance programs, and agricultural production. They affect the types of meals served in government buildings and on military bases. Critics have long argued that current health guidelines wrongly focus on individual nutrients and ignore the effects of processing and additives. This essentially allows food companies to meet basic nutrition requirements while engineering ultra-processed junk foods that carry marketing claims that sound healthy, such as fat-free, less sugar, high in vitamins, reduced sodium. The National School Lunch Program, for example, allows schools to serve children meals consisting of Domino's pizza, Lunchables, Cheez-Its, and other ultra-processed foods that have been formulated to meet government standards for fat, protein, sodium, and whole grains. Yet many of these processed foods are loaded with additives. For example, the turkey in a box of Lunchables served in schools contains 14 different ingredients, including additives for texture, flavor, and shelf life. It's important for the dietary guidelines to start talking about this, said Barry Popkin, professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina. I hate the fact that kids are getting ultra-processed junk foods in schools when they should be eating healthy food. We're making them fat and unhealthy. Of course, there's pushback from the food industry. The dietary guidelines are updated every 5 years by the Departments of Agriculture and Health and Human Services. The next edition won't be published until 2025, but an advisory committee is expected to issue a scientific report next year. One question the committee is examining is whether eating ultra-processed foods influences growth, size, body composition, risk of overweight and obesity, and weight loss and maintenance. The lobbying campaign by the food industry has already started. At least a half dozen food industry trade and lobbying groups have written letters to Health and Human Services urging the government to be cautious about issuing a recommendation on ultra-processed foods. They say that industrial processing makes food safe, convenient, and affordable, and they argue that there's no accepted scientific definition for what exactly constitutes an ultra-processed food. Deidre Tobias, a member of the Guidelines Advisory Committee, said she could not comment on the guidelines while the committee's work is underway, but she said that the evidence from the large epidemiologic studies showing that people who eat more ultra-processed foods have a higher risk of many diseases is, quote, as compelling as it can be. I think there's clearly a critical mass of observational evidence that's been reached, said Tobias, an obesity and nutritional epidemiologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Tobias said that more research was needed to understand the biological mechanisms behind ultra-processed foods and poor health. But she pointed to a landmark 2019 clinical trial carried out at the National Institutes of Health, which found that when people were fed a diet of ultra-processed foods, they consumed roughly 500 extra calories a day and quickly gained weight compared to when they ate a diet of mostly unprocessed foods. Tobias said that ultra-processed foods appear to induce higher, quote, passive intake of calories beyond our energy needs, and that this leads to gradual weight gain and a higher risk of obesity-related diseases. She said the research indicates that it's something inherent in these foods, which is a little bit scary, but also a little reassuring because it might be easier to reformulate these foods than to change our overall food environment. The U.S. is lagging behind other countries. In a study published in July, a group of public health experts concluded that the United States lags behind other countries in addressing ultra-processed foods and its food politics. Jennifer Pomerantz, an author of the study, said it was great news that the Guidelines Advisory Committee was considering a recommendation on ultra-processed foods. It would be a huge step forward, said Pomerantz, an associate professor of public health policy and management at the NYU School of Global Public Health. At least half a dozen other countries have issued dietary guidelines in recent years, explicitly urging people to cut back on ultra-processed foods. Mexico's dietary guidelines, for example, which were published in May, warn people to avoid ultra-processed foods such as processed meats and sausages, chips, crackers, cookies, sweetbread, and boxed cereals. I think there's sufficient evidence to recommend a reduction in calories from ultra-processed foods, said Marion Nessel, an emeritus professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. I wouldn't say don't eat them at all, that makes no sense, but ultra-processed foods belong in a category of, quote, don't eat too much of them. Ultra-processed foods typically contain things like artificial sweeteners, synthetic colors, flavors, emulsifiers, and other ingredients that people don't cook with at home, Nestle said. If you can make it at home in your kitchen, then it's not ultra-processed, Nestle said. When I give lectures on this, I find that people understand the concept right away. There's not much problem defining it. And I'd like to add that definitely this ultra-processed stuff that's done by manufacturers is definitely a real thing, and this article is spot on. The one thing, though, you have to recognize is that it's not just ultra-processed, it's just simply over-processed. Almost all, meaning about 85% or more of our grains are refined. That takes out about two-thirds of the nutrition right there. We have all kinds of refined sugars. Even some of those so-called fruit juices, you know, when compared to fruit, are massively refined and a massive reduction in the amount of nutrition. Refined fats and added fats, whether it's oils, you know, have no resemblance to seeds or nuts. Shortening or butter, you know, butter has really no resemblance to milk or other dairy products. So it's, the three biggest food additives you need to worry about are refined grains, refined sugars, and refined fats that are added to your foods. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, when we're talking about processed foods, it's hard not to talk about salt or sodium. This from CNN. Cutting 1 teaspoon of salt works as well as blood pressure meds, study finds. Cutting 1 teaspoon of salt from your diet each day can lower your top blood pressure reading just as much as a typical hypertension medication, even if you don't have high blood pressure, a new study found. A teaspoon of salt has 2,300 milligrams of sodium. That's the top daily limit for people over 14 recommended by the latest U.S. nutritional guidelines. However, the American Heart Association recommends a diet with less than 1,500 milligrams of sodium a day. This is the first study to show that people who are already on blood pressure medication can lower their blood pressure even more by limiting sodium, said author Narina Allen, professor of preventive medicine at Northwestern University School of Medicine. And regardless of medication, we found 70 to 75% of people are likely to see a reduction in their blood pressure if they lower the sodium in their diet. High blood pressure is often called the silent killer because there are no symptoms. The only way to know if you have it is to test for it. Yet hypertension affects 1 in 3 adults worldwide and can lead to heart attack, heart failure, kidney damage, and stroke. Most people today eat way too much salt because it's added to nearly everything we eat. A teaspoon of salt may seem like a small amount. However, that added salt seems to have an effect on blood pressure that is surprisingly large. Cutting this amount of salt doesn't have any significant side effects unless you count adjusting to a blander diet. When you go from a high-salt diet to a low-salt diet, everything tastes bland. I want to encourage people to stick with it, though, because your taste buds do adjust within a couple of weeks or so, and you really do get taste and flavor back, and normal things will taste very salty. Taste bud adjustment takes a little bit longer, but the blood pressure improvements are pretty quick. Blood pressure medication, however, can have many side effects, including cough, constipation or diarrhea, dizziness, lack of energy, headache, muscle pain, nausea, nervousness, fatigue, weight gain or loss, and erection issues. Typically, though, these ease over time, according to the National Library of Medicine. Putting down the salt shaker is a good start, but it's not where most people get their salt. It's in food you not expect to have a lot of salt. A couple of slices of bread could add 400 or 500 milligrams of salt. A pickle has a full day's worth of salt, and a bowl of soup could have several days' worth of salt in it. So there you go. One of those things that's hard to do because it's so omnipresent in our diet, but it has a big effect on blood pressure, which, of course, that's 1 in 3 worworldwide, is closer to 1 in 2 in adults in the U.S. that have high blood pressure. Okay, well, up next is an interesting article they can get at, a good way to get at overdose deaths. This is from Medical Express. 42% of people who use drugs in rural areas were recently incarcerated, new research finds. New research finds that almost half of people who use illicit drugs in rural areas have been recently incarcerated. Results from a survey of almost 3,000 people in 8 rural areas nationwide who report using illicit drugs have been published in the journal JAMA Network Open. The study found that 42% had been incarcerated, either in prison or local jails, in the preceding 6 months. The findings suggest a prime opportunity to tackle the nation's opioid crisis by expanding addiction treatment to people while they're incarcerated. Currently, access to proven therapy such as medication to treat addiction is limited or unavailable in many jails. You have a reachable time in jails, and most jails are not providing this kind of addiction care, said lead author Dan Hoover, assistant professor of medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine. In a broader sense, our correctional institutions have a mandate to rehabilitate people who have entered the system, and treating addiction is a huge part of that. Effective treatment during incarceration can benefit communities overall, Hoover noted. He cited a study in Rhode Island that measured a 12% decrease in all overdoses statewide after the state implemented medication-assisted therapy in its prison system in 2016. Conversely, Hoover noted that forcing incarcerated individuals to go through withdrawal without treatment leaves them more vulnerable to resuming drug use, criminal conduct, and a heightened risk of overdose once they're released. Many of these individuals are released back to the community within days, Hoover said. Their community is community health. That time in jail is the reachable moment to begin their path to treatment and recovery. Lack of criminal legal system funding, a portion for substance use disorder treatment, and lack of health insurance coverage during incarceration further contribute to poor substance use disorder treatment access for this population. So this just highlights, you know, a well-established public health principle that you need to focus on vulnerable populations and even populations that politically may not be valued as much, such as those that are in the criminal justice system. But if you want to get at the opioid overdose epidemic, this is a prime target. Okay, well, I want to end the regular reporting in this episode with a story about racial ethnic disparities. This is from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Underdiagnosed and undertreated, young black males with ADHD get left behind. It's long been known that black children are underdiagnosed for ADHD compared with white peers. A Penn State report published in Psychiatry Research in September studied the extent of the gap by following more than 10,000 elementary students nationwide from kindergarten to fifth grade through student assessments and parent and teacher surveys. The researchers estimated the odds that black students got diagnosed with a neurological condition were 40% lower than for white students, with all else being equal, including controlling for economic status, student achievement, behavior, and executive functioning. For young black males, the odds of being diagnosed with ADHD were especially stark, almost 60% lower than for white boys in similar circumstances, even though research suggests the prevalence of the condition is likely the same. The racial ADHD divide isn't merely a health concern. It's deepening inequity for black children, and especially black males, said the study's lead author, Paul Morgan, former director of the Center for Educational Disparities Research at Penn State. He now leads the Institute for Social and Health Equity at the University of Albany. ADHD has been diagnosed in nearly 1 out of 10 children in the United States, according to the CDC, with rates surging nearly 70% in the past two decades. It is often a lifetime condition that can be managed with treatments, including therapy and medication. Untreated, children with ADHD face much greater health risks, including drug addiction, self-harm, suicidal behavior, accidents, and untimely death. By adulthood, many people with undiagnosed ADHD have spent years feeling isolated and hopeless. People who study and treat ADHD cite several reasons why young black males fall under the radar, including teachers who are racially biased or have lower expectations of black students and don't recognize an underlying disability, and black parents who are distrustful of teachers and doctors, fearing they'll label and stigmatize their children. Studies have shown that ADHD underdiagnosis contributes to harsher school discipline and to the school-to-prison pipeline. Black kids routinely face punishment, including criminal prosecution, for problem behavior and mental health conditions such as ADHD, while white kids are more likely to be diagnosed with behavioral conditions and receive medical treatment and support. There's a common saying, black kids get cops, white kids get docs. Courtney Zaloff-McCurdy, a researcher and clinician at the University of Washington School of Medicine, focuses on decreasing mental health disparities in early childhood. By preschool, she said, black children with ADHD symptoms are more likely to be expelled and less likely to receive appropriate treatment than their white peers. Her research has found that teachers' judgments of children are heavily influenced by their opinions of the kids' parents, and that often determines whether their children are evaluated for behavioral conditions and given appropriate support, or simply kicked out of class. She said the Penn State findings confirm what she's seen in clinics and heard from parents. Zaloff McCurdy also pointed to research that shows black children are 2.4 times as likely as white kids to receive a diagnosis of conduct disorder compared with a diagnosis of ADHD. She said the racial bias and overdiagnosis of conditions such as oppositional defiant disorder, defined by symptoms as being uncooperative and hostile towards authority figures, result in more punitive consequences, such as being isolated in separate classrooms. To fix inequities in ADHD diagnosis, mental health experts see a need for increasing culturally sensitive screening and addressing black families' concerns about potential bias and racism. Ensuring access to information about symptoms and treatments for ADHD may help address obstacles to care. And of course, it gets at the underlying, pervasive, systematic public health effects of racism.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, that brings us to our regular feature of bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give a link again, at the end of the list. Well, our record-breaking 36 bonus articles this week, so let's get to it. Number one, after Ohio vote, advocates in a dozen states are trying to put abortion on 2024 ballots. So Ohio is helping lead the rush towards citizen initiatives to make abortion a right. Bonus article two, how Ohio's election results will both protect abortion and affect maternal mortality in the state. So this is just a good overview of how this amendment will produce better public health results in Ohio. Bonus article three, Ohio GOP lawmakers call to block courts from implementing new abortion amendment. The lesson here is that no matter what win you have, people will try to roll it back. So this is basically the legislative branch trying to carve out for themselves what would normally be a court process. Bonus article four, how is Ohio managing the Medicaid unwinding process and eligibility? I've reported a lot on this, and it's been real problematic across the country. The short story for Ohio, good news, Ohio does better than most states. Bonus article five, Supreme Court looks poised to uphold ban on guns for accused domestic abusers. So this is a Rahimi case I've reported a lot on, and it's really important because if this ban on guns for violent domestic abusers is not upheld, we could see a lot more deaths in domestic abuse situations. Bonus article six, narcissism, immorality, and lack of empathy, the dark psychology that can poison elites. So there's some psychological dynamics going in with elite rule. Bonus article seven, public health approaches to gambling, a global review of legislative trends. So it's still in the early days of dealing with gambling as a public health issue, just one more form of addiction that can be damaging both to individuals, families, and entire communities. And we tend to have individual approaches to mitigate this. But this global review shows that while we're making some progress, we have a long ways to go. Bonus Article 8, tapped out. New Orleans drinking water testing procedures don't follow government regulations. They even go as far as lying about the results, submitting false results. Not good. Bonus Article 9. U.S. regulators order Minnesota to clean up nitrate-contaminated water that is due to manure pollution. So nitrates are dangerous at high levels, and this comes largely from manure, which is coming from these concentrated animal feeding operations, and a lot of that manure is used on farms and runs off into the water that we end up drinking. Bonus Article 10. FDA moves to pull common drug used by pork industry, citing human cancer risk. So another thing about eating meat, if you're eating pork, you've been eating another human carcinogen that's added to treat pigs for diseases. One more reason not to eat meat. Bonus Article 11, reducing pesticides in food. Major food manufacturers earn an F grade. This is another story about voluntary regulations not working well. A major food manufacturer set about 5 years ago, for their stockholders and such, you know, to make themselves look good, what we're going to do about reducing pesticides in food. And the fact is they've made almost no progress whatsoever, getting an F grade. Bonus Article 12, polluting industries say the cost of cleaner air is too high. Well, basically what they mean is for them, but not for the public. They're talking about many, many, many more times benefit for the public than what it actually costs for industry. Bonus Article 13, pollution is driving today's reverse Great Migration. The first great black migrations built the Midwest. In return, black communities receive pollution and toxic contamination. So the only area of the country that has a growing black population is the South. This is, of course, where the Great Migration happened from back in the 50s and 60s. But a lot of this is being driven by poor conditions in black communities in places that were originally seen as a better way of life. Bonus Article 14, how pharmacy deserts are putting the health of black and Latino Americans at risk. So the reduction of pharmacies is disproportionately in black and Latino neighborhoods and causing these pharmacy deserts. Not good. Okay, follow-up story, bonus Article 15, pulse oximeters, inaccuracies in darker-skinned people require urgent action, state attorney generals tell the FDA. So this is where if folks with darker skin are using these to measure their oxygen, the little thing you put on your finger, it doesn't work as well with black folks and brown folks because those pigments in the skin look like you've got hemoglobin in your blood and give you false high readings of oxygen, which may not lead to a good assessment. Definitely need to take care of that. Bonus Article 16. Countless kids are colorblind and don't know about it. Here's how to help. So with a pulse oximeter story, there's some people who are colorblind and that doesn't necessarily work well, but people that are actually colorblind, and it happens way more common in male kids, and there's a lot of kids who don't learn that they're colorblind till they're later in their school or even as adults, and this can affect their learning and interactions with the world greatly. Bonus Article 17, 10 ways MedPAC commissioners think regulators should fix Medicare Advantage plans. So I've spoken a lot about Medicare Advantage plans being a problem, a good rundown of those deficiencies and how we might fix them. Bonus Article 18, you have a right to know why health insurers deny your claim. Some insurers still won't tell you. If this is a problem, this article may give you some tips on dealing with that. Bonus Article 19, feds launch birthing-friendly designation on web-based care compare tool. So this will give you the link to that basic web-based care compare tool that you can look at various factors in different hospitals. Good news for us locally here in Toledo, both Mercy and Toledo Hospital have birthing-friendly designations. Bonus Article 20, ambulance rides for just $100. Government advisors want major billing fixes. So this is proposing limiting no more than $100 out-of-pocket costs for ambulances. The downside is it probably will not address the huge charges meaning people still be making huge profits off these ridiculous gaps in our healthcare system. Bonus Article 21, VA reports major uptick in veterans care after passage of toxic exposure law. So this is something I've reported on before, where rather than requiring years-long battles to get care, they've just determined that people who were exposed in different settings to like toxic burn pits and, you know, Agent Orange and all those kinds of things can just automatically be getting care. That's another reason why we should just have universal health care. Get rid of all those barriers. Bonus Article 22, how to unlock healthier communities. Team up with librarians. Another great asset. This is an example how public health and healthcare folks can team up with librarians for more healthy communities. Bonus Article 23, syphilis cases in U.S. newborn skyrocket in 2022, highlighting hole in basic public health infrastructure. So sexually transmitted infection is stuff, something that local health departments have done for a long time. And syphilis is the one that's most sensitive to holes in that system because, yeah, syphilis is a very, very serious problem. And it's been skyrocketing. Reported on that before. Bonus Article 24, why it's so tough to reduce unnecessary medical care. Short story, profits and the culture of more is better as far as doing procedures and such. Bonus Article 25, mind-altering ketamine becomes latest pain treatment, despite little research or regulation. So this is one where, you know, ketamine is actually only approved as an anesthetic, but it's being used for pain treatment and psychedelic psychology use and treatment as an adjunct to psychological interventions, that type of thing. But it's kind of getting out ahead of both the research and the regulation. Bonus Article 26, after antidepressants, a loss of sexuality. Some patients are speaking up about lasting sexual problems after stopping antidepressants, a poorly understood condition. So one more thing to consider if you're taking antidepressants or considering taking antidepressants. Bonus Article 27, common cat-borne parasite is positively associated with frailty in older adults. So this is kind of, if you have cats, you want to be careful just as far as hygiene and stuff because it's a pretty common parasite that gets transmitted and generally doesn't cause a real problem. But as you get older and your immune system gets weaker, the infection can be activated and cause health problems in older adults. Bonus Article 28. Is the U.S. reporting system for vaccine safety broken? Looks like there's some real issues as far as transparency and the ability for providers to interface with the national system. Bonus Article 29. HPV vaccines are so effective that new screening policies may be in order. If you actually do widespread HPV vaccines and do both boys and girls, it actually gets rid of the strains of HPV that cause cancer. Great news. Bonus Article 30. History of 18th and 19th century disease outbreaks speak powerfully to the present. A lot of this is just simply about othering. When we blame things on others, outgroups, it doesn't help the public health. Bonus Article 31, U.S. CDC to expand surveillance of traveler samples of respiratory viruses. So this is like in airports, people from coming from international destinations, a good way to get to travel the move of respiratory viruses across the globe. Bonus Article 32, more Americans say they're in cognitive fog. Adults in their 20s, 30s, and 40s are driving the trend. Researchers point to long COVID as a major cause. So this is still the reverberating effects of COVID with a major pandemic, and it's still happening. People still get long COVID, and it affects young adults very much so. They figure there's about a million folks or so that have disabling cognitive issues. Bonus Article 33, the rise and fall of antibiotics. What would a post-antibiotic world look like? So this is a good overview of the antimicrobial resistance issues and what, if we don't deal with those very well, what a post-antibiotic world would look like. Not good. Bonus Article 34, the gas mask for all approach to air pollution. What could possibly go wrong? Now, this is kind of a modern public health fable where they use air pollution as something that when there was less air pollution, you know, and people had problems with air pollution, people think it's just an individual thing, and maybe they'll give you a gas mask so you don't have to breathe the air pollution. But as air pollution becomes predominant, and actually most people are suffer from it, you know, you get into this weird thing where you're going to give gas masks for everybody rather than deal with the source of pollution. And actually, this whole fable, if you will, analogy, metaphor, is used to also talk about what is happening with obesity and our food system, is that now, rather than giving everybody Ozempic or such a gas mask, we actually need to deal with a core problem, which is a food system gone wrong. Bonus article 35. WHO warns of worrying trends in disease spread in Gaza. So just over the first month, which doesn't include the most recent like week or so, when water, the lack of clean water has been exponentially increasing, that there's been a many fold increase in gastrointestinal diseases, particularly among infants and young children. And lastly, but not leastly, bonus article 36. This week has the Great American Smokeout, where you can take the first step towards a smoke-free life. So if you or someone you care about is a smoker and they might be interested in quitting smoking, a good way to do take a first step towards that is you can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW for resources to quit smoking. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on this show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-